Good evening. Buddha was awakened when he saw that evening star, the morning star, and felt the profound connection between the star and the very ground on which he sat. So Buddha's mind and body is the interconnectedness of all things. I am inspired to revisit old territory with some new literature. So I'll read you a few things tonight. I was really moved by Mary Grace's lecture last week on loving kindness and compassion, where she looked so closely at the Metta Sutta, and so I want to talk more about compassion and loving kindness, and what kind of effort does it take to lead with your heart open, to keep your heart open as I go about my life in the world, in the universe. Even at the risk of her life, a mother watches over her only child, so with a boundless heart. What does it take to have that kind of a boundless heart here in the world, going about our daily business? Mary Orr talked about a situation of seeing someone you love and feeling that kind of open-heartedness. And in my question or my observation after the lecture, I remembered when we had a Zen talk by a visitor from Green Gulch who talked about his feeling of seeing his daughter come down the path and that opening of the heart he experienced, and he took on the practice of why can't I have that open-heartedness with everyone I see? What a practice to take that on. And you know, what effort, what would it take to have that kind of open-heartedness? You know, when you really do feel joyful, open-hearted, compassionate with another person, your sense of self really is in the background, or if not, it's this kind of bigger, porous, more connecting self. The heart really is that kind of connecting organ. I've said that before. I like that image. If our vow is to live in Buddha's mind and body, or express Buddha's mind and body, because that's, of course, the body we have, that heart has to really be on the front page, on the front burner. Kind of open and alive. that kind of porous, open, connecting self, it's beyond perception. We're not really thinking about, you know, the self. We're not really saying, gee, I'm a good guy for having these nice thoughts towards that other person. You're not really dwelling in that fixed self that identifies itself as Patrick or Chuck or Chris. It's that small self or that fixed self is more in the background, and we've got that open, big-hearted, connecting self. And we're not thinking about it. That's the part that I've written down here. It's beyond perception. The Metta Sutta comes to us from the Pali Canon, the early Buddhist literature. We've got similar examples in the later Mahayana literature that I've looked at. Of course, a nice one is here in the Lotus Sutra, the chapter on the Bodhisattva never disparaging is his name. Actually, in this translation, it's about the Bodhisattva named Never Disrespectful. Chapter 20 in the Lotus Sutra. It's a nice story. Maybe I'll read for a while. And supposedly this all takes place several eons before Shakyamuni Buddha. At that time, there was a Bodhisattva monk named Never Disrespectful. Great strength. Oh, never disrespectful. I'll put on my glasses because there was a punctuation mark there. At that time, there was a Bodhisattva monk named Never Disrespectful. Why do you think he was named Never Disrespectful? That monk bowed before everyone he met, whether monk, nun, layman, or laywoman, and praised them, saying, "I deeply respect you. I deeply respect you. I would never dare to be disrespectful or arrogant toward you. Why is that? Because all of you are practicing the Bodhisattva way, and surely you will become Buddhas." So he was seeing Buddha in everyone he met. What would that take? What would that take? The monk did not devote himself to reading and reciting sutras, but simply went around bowing to people. If he saw these four groups, the monks, the nuns, the laywoman, the layman, if he saw these four groups off in a distance, he would make a point of even going over to them and bowing and praising them, saying, "I would never dare disrespect you, because surely you are all to become Buddhas." Now these four groups often became angry, enraged, and mean-spirited. They reviled and cursed him, saying, "This arrogant monk, he takes it upon himself to announce that he does not respect us and assures us of becoming Buddhas. Where did he come from? We have no use for such empty, false assurances." Thus he passed many years, constantly being cursed, but never becoming angry or enraged, and always saying, "Surely you are to become Buddhas." When he spoke this way, some would hit him with sticks, tiles, stones, or even throw zucchinis at him. But even if he ran off and stood at a distance, he would continually cry out loudly,
I would not disrespect you. Surely you are all to become Buddhas. And because he always spoke in this way, the extremely arrogant monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen called him never disrespectful. When this monk was nearing death, from the sky he heard 200 million billion verses of the Lotus Sutra, which the majestic voice King Buddha had previously taught, and he was able to receive and embrace all of them. Immediately he obtained the purity of vision and of the faculties of the ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind described earlier. Having obtained the purity of these faculties, his life was extended for another 2 million billion myriads of years, and he taught the Lotus Sutra everywhere for all people. Then the extremely arrogant monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen who had slighted and shown contempt for him and given him the name Never Disrespectful, seeing him with the power of great divine faculties, powers of joyful and eloquent speech, and powers of great goodness and tranquility, and having heard him preach, all believed in him and followed him. The Bodhisattva transformed a multitude of tens of millions of billions, enabling them to dwell in a state of supreme awakening. After his lifetime, he met 200 billion Buddhas. All of them were named Sun and Moon Light. That's L-I-G-H-T. And under their Dharma, he taught the Lotus Sutra. So, this is the story of the Bodhisattva Never Disrespectful, who took on the same practice that we were talking about last week of just seeing Buddha in everyone we meet. Here's a little sidelight. I'm on our union negotiating team, contract negotiating team. And it's a funny position, because there I am sitting on my side of the table with the other members of my union. And across the table is the county personnel department. And we've got different ideas. It's kind of a setup for duality. And there I am, kind of practicing seeing everyone as a Buddha, as being... I'm trying this practice. So what a great opportunity. What a great opportunity. The county personnel director representing the county in this negotiation. Her name, she's an Indian woman. Her first name is Ajita. And I did the same thing 3 years ago, so I've gotten to know Ajita pretty well. But interestingly, I was, you know, studying this last night, and there was a footnote that in here that directed me to another chapter of the Lotus Sutra that I didn't know very well, that I'd never read before, and the Buddha was addressing Maitreya, the future Buddha, and all through that chapter, he was calling Maitreya by his nickname, Ajita. So here, it was just this junction of the moon and stars. I know an Ajita. And I am trying every day to see her as the Buddha.
And it's the same story was right in here, you know, written a couple thousand years ago, or put down on paper a couple thousand years ago. So I thought that was a great serendipitous situation. Dogen addresses the same thing. Of course, Dogen, in the way of the kind of Chinese koans, might say that the Lotus Sutra might say that Bodhisattva, never disrespectful, got it 80%, and Dogen is gonna bring it all home with another 20%. We now have available Kaz Ta-Nehisi's complete 95 fascicles of the Shobo Genzo, and it's really my go-to. It's really where I start, because his language is so accessible, and it really is a nice heart. I get a feeling of real heart in all of Kaz's books and translations. And so here was a sutra, here was a fascicle that I wasn't familiar with until I got this book. It was fascicle 22, Reading a Sutra. The practice and realization of unsurpassable complete enlightenment is brought forth sometimes by a teacher and sometimes by a sutra. A teacher is a Buddha ancestor of the entire self. A sutra is a sutra of the entire self. We say this because you yourself are the self of all Buddha ancestors and the self of all sutras. Although it is called the self, it is not bound by quotations you or I. It's not bound by the words you or I. It's a vital eyeball. It's a vital fist. Thus, there is remembering, reading, chanting, copying, receiving, and maintaining a sutra. All of these are the practice realization of Buddha ancestors. So here is Dogen reminding us that we are all Buddhas, that we have the mind and body of Buddha, the mind and body of interconnectedness, the mind and body that sees one thing, that sees unity between that distant star and the very ground, the body, the Buddha, or the Buddha that looks across the table and sees the mirror vision of our Buddha nature. And I want to throw in my piece that I think you have to do that with your open heart, to really dwell in that Buddha body and mind that sees Buddha everywhere, even in the mirror. That's done with that heart mind, that compassion wisdom. And Dogen is reminding us that is complete, unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. That heart wisdom. You know, when I think of the Buddhas that I've known, let's say Catherine, moved, inspired by her, moved to sit another period in Sesshin, moving me to settle in the mornings here at 5:45. I have to be grateful for that practice and the inspiration she's given me over the years. When I think of the times I've heard Reb talk and been so moved by his scholarship and how he mixes it so completely with his open heart, these are Buddhas that I know, that I don't have to question myself too much that they're Buddhas, and just talking and thinking about them and remembering them, I sort of see Catherine a couple times a week. It doesn't take much to remember Catherine. But it's not so hard to have an open heart. And there's that loving kindness practice that we've all practiced before, we've all at least heard before, you wish loving kindness to someone that you already are totally in love with. You know, that's an easy practice. You start there. I wish them loving kindness. I wish them freedom from suffering. I wish them ease and contentment. And then you pick someone that you're, you know, kind of neutral about, but you can just imagine them having loving kindness and contentment. And you get kind of progressively harder with people that you have a little harder time with. Maybe yourself is in there someplace. Even though I messed that one up, can I wish myself loving kindness? So we've all heard that exercise. Dogen is reminding us, you know, of that exercise to just, as we dwell in our Buddha body and Buddha mind, can we, like the Bodhisattva never disparaging, can we meet the 200 million billion other Buddhas around us and all practice the Lotus Sutra together? So Dogen is reminding us of that practice. In Zazen, we can sit and put down our thoughts temporarily as they float by. Just let them go without holding on to them, without kind of forming the words and phrases over and over again into a fixed, solid idea that really is the that will represent a firm, fixed self. So Zazen is this bigger. We're reminded of our bigger, better connected, more intimate self. I just read Dogen's line. A teacher is a Buddha, ancestor of the entire self. So that when we take up this practice, we're already Buddha ancestors. Already we're exercising this Buddha mind and body of interconnectedness. We're appreciating the dynamic function of all the causes and conditions of the universe. Dogen says, a sutra is a sutra of the entire self.
when you become, we say this because you yourself are the self of the Buddha ancestors and you're the self of all sutras. A sutra is a sutra of the entire self. And of course, in Buddhism, our life is the sutra that we study so hard, that we study so carefully, that we have the opportunity to study moment after moment. When we pick up a Dharma book, when we pick up a sutra like the Lotus Sutra, or when we pick up Katagiri's lessons on the Uji, Dogen's Uji, when we come to class here on Sunday nights and study Uji with Kokyo, we're visiting that the Buddha ancestor of the self. We're visiting the sutra of our life. We come to the classes because when we study, we're already resonating with Uji. We're resonating with the Lotus Sutra. That resonance, that vibration of the whole universe is what jostled us to the front door here of Santa Cruz Zen Center. This is the resonance of our life. And of course, Dogen brings it on home again when he says to study Buddhism is to study the self. So I'd never read this sutra before a couple months ago, or not this fascicle, but you know, it made sense right away. A teacher is a Buddha ancestor of the entire self. A sutra is a sutra of the entire self. You know, we'd been resonating to that lesson from the very first, you know, minute we came into the front door here. I've said this in Way-Seeking Mind talks that, you know, for lots of reasons I came here for the first time 19 years ago, and I thought that first lecture that Catherine gave that I heard, I thought that she had been overhearing my therapy appointment, my last therapy appointment. It, you know, the great matter, life and death, is what we do here. And when we come and sit on this cushion, putting down our thoughts, letting go of our thoughts, opening the hand of thought, we are experiencing that resonance from the entire universe. In this study of the self, our heart is engaged. We lead with the heart. What effort does it take to keep that open? Any other thoughts on that kind of effort, just to lead with compassion, when we find ourselves balled up, when I find myself, you know, reacting to Ajita, saying what? What is she offering? And saying, okay, you know, my practice is to see this is, she's just read me a sutra. You know, what is that effort? Does anybody else at the table know that I've put that effort forward? Have they heard this grunt coming from the deepest bowels of the universe?
to make me kind of open my heart that way. I don't know. I don't know if they overheard that turning of my heart. Any other thoughts about that effort, Kathy?
What does it sound like when you receive the sutra of the person on the opposite side of the negotiating ritual? And when you have a different idea? And you're really, really practicing deeply to meet the situation as a sutra. What do you sound like? What do you say?
Well,
you can't get the book out and, you know, share about our friend, right?
Maitreya.
You have to be in this professional.
Actually, when I first heard you, I thought you said, "What does her sutra sound like? What does her what does she sound like?" And so I have to say that it is this mindfulness bell that resonates through my whole body. You know, the tightening of my shoulders and my chest and meets the resonance of her voice perfectly. And I hear this mindfulness bell that, oh, that's the Buddha. And so then what comes out of the discussion, you know, hopefully is this, you know, how would I sit in Dokusan with this Buddha? And I've, you know, sat in Dokusan hundreds of times in these 19 years. And, you know, I do as much as possible with my heart open, with beginner's mind. You know, I really want to hear what the future Buddha has to say. But it's a real transformation, and it's kicked off by that tightening, by that you know, that lo and behold is the perfect resonance with her voice. And sometimes it takes a long time to hear that. Sometimes that bell has to ring really loud. This morning, after Zazen, I got in a long conversation out on the bench here with Rob. And I was just on a roll. I was just going. It was a nice conversation. I thought it was a nice conversation. And Rob says, "Oh, I hear the bell ring." I said, "What? There's the school bell?" And only after I listened a little more carefully did I hear that Kokyo was ringing that Rob all this time was patiently waiting for Dokusan and was waiting. It was he had Buddha ears on, and was he heard from the first strike. He heard the bell, but it took me a long time to hear that bell. So sometimes when Maitreya is speaking to me from the other side of the table, it'll take days for me to hear that bell. And so I wanted to tell you the truth in that it sometimes takes days. Sometimes it takes even longer with other Buddhas. But my body just isn't ready. I'm not ready to hear their Buddha, their sutras. Sometimes it takes a very long time for me to have the Buddha ears, the Buddha tongue, the Buddha nose that bodhisattva, never disparaging, never disrespectful, you know, gained you know, with his lifetime of practice. So thank you. Kokyo.
Help to try to imagine the other person's pain or where they're at. Or does that seem to be speculative? Like in this case.
With Ajita, okay. I've never used that practice with her.
Sometimes it's hard to imagine where someone's coming from.
Yeah. I've had the experience that before that I have this real turning. When they say something that is just so universally human, that I see them as a teenager talking to their mothers, that my mind and their mind is totally united, and the time that I'm thinking about, I was so far away, my Buddha ears were so closed that I had to. It was the speed of light for our mind merging, but it really was. It was their words, you know. So it wasn't me putting on a practice. But I think that is a good practice, especially. Pardon me. Yeah, oh, totally. Because this definitely was about, you know, teenage life and you know, our painful teenage life. What was I going to say? And of course, in the Metta Sutta, that image of even at the mother, at the risk of her life, protects her child. What a great idea to sort of, if it's hard for you to see this grown-up Buddha, can you see the baby Buddha as we wash him with the sweet water, and just know that have that kind of recognition. That is a good practice. Thank you. Shuso.
What's coming up for me is what I would call, in these situations that you're talking about, kind of the near enemy of loving kindness. Because, especially when Kokyo was talking about imagining their pain or imagining them as a child, it seems to me that could come from a place of, well, this person is so wrong and my ideas are so correct that I'm making this effort to extend, you know, to see why they're so confused. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if that seems really off base to me, mm-hmm. especially, you know, if you're in a situation of, it's about ideas, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about mm-hmm. views when you're across the
negotiation. Yeah, right.
They have a view. And they have a view. And often, you know, it's about views
mm-hmm.
or our perceptions of mm-hmm. those views.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm trying to put together the part about views with just, you know, the open-hearted to who a person is, to their whole being and everything that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having trouble putting those two things together.
Yeah. So I'm hearing this in a couple of ways. Initially, I was hearing that there's a little bit of mindfulness that you're coming from real different places, and the effort that I might have is really planned out. It's not that non-perceptual interconnectedness, but you know, it's almost like that mindfulness bell, or at least that initial start, is the what's the term? It's not in the words, but that we chant in the morning. But it's
responds to the inquiring
impulse. Yeah. So it's a point in the right direction, and if you keep going down that path, you know, and you can find, and you're relating then to mutuality, you know, then the self, the ego, starts dropping away. And so, lo and behold, you end up in the same place, even if you have to start off saying, I'm a bad person, I'm not getting this, I don't like what she says, I'm not relating to this, but let me at least try. But then I started hearing something else. What was the trouble you were having? You said you.
Well, what you just said actually was really helpful, because the way I heard it was the practice or the effort is in meeting the person fully.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
The views are expressed and listening.
Yeah.
But what's really just the continued effort is meeting the person,
yeah.
And then whatever happens with the views happens in
the context. There is that grunt heard around the world. There is in Kathy's world, there is the groan zone, and the
technical term.
Yeah. The mind of body, the mind and body of Buddha, the unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment is the willingness to enter the groan zone, is the willingness to go, I even have to try to understand what she's saying there. That is already, that is the connecting, that's another manifestation of this compassionate heart that's groaning the whole way through. That's the willingness to go there is the open-heartedness. Thank you for helping us think through that. That was nice.
Was it also maybe part of something in this question about we may be looking at this, like I appreciated that comment on that Kamai thing, that we may just, or we know that we're right, actually. And like, just try to, you know, see where that wrong person's coming from.
Yeah, so we can subtly
take
care of them until they actually
come
get
around.
At that point, it's only a Buddha with a Buddha. You're going to help out that other Buddha over there. Another translation. You're going to point out another translation of the sutra. I like that. Thank you. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways
unsurpassable.